is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in the digital age. This is episode 63, and today I'm joined via Google Hangout on Air by Rebecca Goldner. Rebecca defended her dissertation at Villanova University in the spring of 2013 with a dissertation entitled Lived Flesh, Touch and Embodiment in Aristotle's De Anima. She also has an excellent article published on the topic in Epoche, a journal in the history of philosophy, entitled Touch and Flesh in Aristotle's De Anima. It was a hearing of a version of this article at the Ancient Philosophy Society in 2010, and then a subsequent reading of it in Epoche that first brought Rebecca's work to my attention. And that paper, in fact, informed my own forthcoming paper on touch in Aristotle entitled On Touch and Life in the De Anima. So given these connections, we thought it only appropriate to continue our discussion of touch and Aristotle on the digital dialogue. So welcome, Rebecca, to the digital dialogue.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
This is a great experiment for us. First digital dialogue live on air through the wonders of Google Hangout on air. And so I really appreciate, Rebecca, your being willing to go sort of fly without a net here. So this is a great experiment. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your the paper that we looked at together that I know you'll be delivering at the Society for Ancient Greek Philosophy, I guess, this fall, right?
Yes, it's actually for the for their meeting in conjunction with the APS. Sorry, with the APA.
Right.
Baltimore.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm.
And another version of this paper will be presented at SPAP in this, yeah, so. So that paper is primarily deals with what became the end of the dissertation and what I didn't realize until well into the dissertation was going to be the end, this work on flesh. My work brings together Aristotle and is, I consider myself somebody who works primarily on Aristotle, but I bring together Aristotle with Merleau-Ponty, the French phenomenologist, who is, I think, probably best known for his work on perception, but also his later incomplete work on flesh. The last thing that he produced, it was, in fact, unfinished at the time of his death. And I didn't realize for a long time that that's where I was headed. And I was happily surprised to see that when it all came together, the last section of the dissertation had developed into what I think, I hope, is a pretty rigorous discussion of the way in which there might be what I call a kinship between these two thinkers on the topic of flesh.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things that you reference briefly in the paper, but don't go into too much detail on, is the question, I guess it's in the at the end of Merleau-Ponty reader in the section on man and adversity, where Merleau-Ponty is actually asked about Aristotle and asked about particularly Aristotle's conception of touch, you know, and it seemed, at least from my reading of that Merleau-Ponty was, you know, happy to embrace Aristotle, but was a little unsure about exactly how far he wanted to go with doing that.
Yeah, that's how it seems to me, and this was really nothing more than it actually arises on the question of actuality and activity. There's a little bit of a discussion after a paper that he's given, and he's pressed a little bit on Aristotle, and he's willing to engage insofar as he says, well, if this is what you think Aristotle is getting at, yeah, I'll say I agree with Aristotle, but he really backs away from it and says, I'm no great Aristotelian. I have, you know, this is not something I've worked on a lot. And that was something that I wanted to make clear throughout my own work, was that this is not, for example, Heidegger, right, where there's a clear engagement in reading of Aristotle being offered. This is somebody who's doing something entirely different. He's doing his own work. He's doing work that comes out of his training as a psychologist, out of his work as a philosopher. And what I was seeing, and this was, in fact, one of the impetus for the dissertation, was I'm seeing some similarities between what he's producing and what I thought Aristotle had produced.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting the way that it comes about, because what you have is are sort of two thinkers coming at an issue of embodiment from two different traditions, two different perspectives, and coming to a certain kind of resonance. And I think maybe that's where we could probably try to head with regard to our discussion, too. So maybe we could start out by focusing a little bit on Aristotle, the nature of touch in Aristotle, and some of the themes there that you think are important.
Sure. So the discussion of touch takes up really the central portion of the De Anima. In the second book of De Anima, Aristotle embarks on a discussion of sensation. He's also dealt with nutrition in the early part of that. What he does is he deals with each of the senses in order. And to some degree, he treats touch by talking a little bit about sensation in general. And then he goes through, beginning with sight, how each sense works, and ends with a discussion of touch. I've always found this discussion of touch to be one of the most rich in the De Anima. And in fact, he deals with touch more in the De Anima than any other sense. He treats it more thoroughly, and he comes back to it, in fact, at the end of Book 3 to talk about touch again. It's the one sense that he references again at the end. So in his treatment of touch, some of the things that I found particularly engaging were the problems. He begins by saying touch is difficult. There are a lot of problems surrounding touch. And he says, you know, among those problems, we have to really wrestle with the unity of touch. It doesn't have a single identifiable object the way that other, you know, vision deals with or is directed towards color. What is visible, color is visible. It's not that clear with touch. The other major problem that he raises is the question of, so if he wants to keep all of the senses analogous, he has to say that there's a sense, a medium, and an object. The sense is also comes along with a sense organ. And for touch, he's unclear, at least in the anima, as to what the organ itself might be. He never comes out in the anima and states clearly what the organ of touch is. But also, the medium is really problematic as well. It's not as simple.
Right, exactly. I mean, one of the things that is attracting me to the problem of touch is as you read through the De Anima, you really begin to realize that what you sort of thought, if you've only read, let's say, the Metaphysics, where the priority of sight is seems to be emphasized, certainly in the first book, in the first few lines of the Metaphysics, where Aristotle emphasizes that humans take pleasure in sight more than anything else. And there are certainly the aspects of sight that are important, its ability to synthesize, to see things in a kind of panoptic way in the sense of seeing a lot of things all at once, a simultaneity. There's a reason probably why sight became such a primary metaphor for knowing, such a primary way in which we think about our own interactions with the world in terms of at least the history of philosophy. And then you come to the De Anima and you hear about sight. I mean, actually, sight is the first of the sentences, first of the powers of perceiving that is handled specifically. But then you begin to realize, well, wait a minute, touch has a priority actually in a way that is really important, and it has a set of problems that you mentioned that make it central to the De Anima.
Yes. And, I mean, what you're referencing there, you know, the Metaphysics, the opening lines of the Metaphysics, this is something that if you're going to work on touch in Aristotle and, you know, you're engaged in this as well, you really have to be able to say, well, no, he does use, you know, the term proton first in a way with reference to touch. But you have to wrestle with the Metaphysics and other claims. But I think, and I argue this at different places in my work, and this is one of the reasons I also make this turn to Merleau-Ponty, that there's something anachronistic in our reading of Aristotle that comes from a kind of Cartesianism. When we privilege vision, when we privilege sight, and particularly when we privilege the distance between sentient and sensible. And sight allows us to do that, and you know, feminist philosophy has taken this up in various ways and said, you know, there's a problem when we privilege sight over touch in that, you know, we're not engaging in the world and the body in the same way. And basically, you know, there have been claims that the history of Western philosophy is sort of scopophilic in a way. And I'm not sure Aristotle was. There are places where we could certainly say, yes, the opening of the metaphysics seems to give some importance to sight, but there are many, many other places. And in particular, insofar as we want to consider the human being as an animal and as a living being, I think we need to go back to touch to really understand what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with that. And so maybe let's talk a little bit. Maybe you'll forgive me for this one, but let's flesh out the aspects of
it's hard to avoid this.
the different aspects of touch. I mean, so first of all, you laid out nicely, I think, the problem that touch, or the crisis, I think, at least the way I'm thinking about it, the crisis that touch puts the De Anima as a project into, namely, what is this kind of power of perceiving that doesn't have a discernible object, that might not have a medium in the same way as, let's say, the distal senses do, seeing, hearing, even smelling, that seems to blur between tasting and touching, right? There's some blurring of the boundaries between senses. So on the one hand, you know, the traditional view of Aristotle as great systematizer, right? This the notion of touch challenges him to try to give a coherent account of the soul with regard to these problems. So what's your sense of how he addresses that in the De Anima?
Well, as I said, you know, I do think that if you look at simply how much he deals with touch, he's affording a kind of privilege there. And I think that part of the reason that he works through the other senses first is because he wants to be able to maintain an analogy. He wants to use that paradigm of sense with its organ, medium, and object. So that when he gets to touch, it is true that he's going to say, you know, there is more than one object. It is, you know, touches of the hot and the cold, the moist and the dry. There's a few, and actually different lists if you look at the De Sensu. But and that is in some ways, he wants to say, and yet, you know, it is still a unity. That's really what's at stake for him, is saying that this is one sense, touch. And it is a unified sense, in spite of the fact that it has more than one thing.
Yeah. But in one sense, we have there's the problem of the unity of this power of perceiving itself, namely touch. Mm-hmm. But then it's also a question of, I mean, at one point in the middle of the De Anima, he's worried that, well, touch is threatening the entire account of the senses because it threatens the idea that there's an analogy between the way they all function, right? That, you know, sight has an object, has a medium. Hearing, we can talk about, has an object, has a medium, and they're identifiable, whereas now touch not only is a question whether it is itself one power of perceiving, but is it consistent with his account of the other powers of perceiving also?
Right. And I do think that it is, in spite of that sort of anomaly about it seems to be directed at more than one thing. One of the things that he will say, both in the De Anima and in other works, is that these attributes, the one, the hot, the cold, the moist, the dry, these are the attributes of body as body. Now, he never comes right out and says then, so clearly the object of touch is body, and it would be really nice if he had said that. And yet, there's a way in which we want to say, yeah, it's the very things that make a body, that are the object of touch. But I think one of the reasons he can't say it's body is because body is too substantial. Senses have to be directed at qualities that inhere in things. Body is too primary in that sense, but in that way. But I do think that there's a unity to these things that we see in other places. They constitute bodies. They, in fact, constitute perishable, perceptible bodies. So if we look at the generation and corruption, those are the kinds of things he's going to say there, is that when you bring together these different contraries, ultimately we get perceptible substances, and the primary form of perception of these substances is touch. They're tangible.
Right. I mean, and actually that brings up another way in which touch is primary in Aristotle, is that it delineates sentient living things from other living things like plants, right? Mm-hmm. Which he says differ from animals insofar as they don't have this sense of touch, which is always a little bit problematic to think about.
Yes, absolutely. And really, touch is the defining characteristic of animal life for Aristotle. He says, you know, that unless you have touch, you are not an animal. And when the sense of touch is destroyed, when the capacity to touch is destroyed, so is the animal. And that is, so it's, in some ways, it's actually a very nice, clear delimitation that he's given us. And yet, there are going to be those times when those boundaries get blurred, so that, you know, there are ways in which the act of nutrition, which is what marks the life of a plant, seems to look a little bit like there's contact involved, there's kinds of continuity involved, but it's not animate touch in the same way that he's going to draw that limit and say, now you have an animal. And, of course, he's a little funny about that. There are things that he has to say then must be plants or must be animals, and there are a few places, sea creatures in particular, that he gets into that are going to really become problematic in a way, and we might recognize them as one thing, whereas he would have said they were another because they have an ability to touch.
Right. I mean, and I think one of the things that this whole discussion of touch brings us to is a larger question about how to read Aristotle in a way, because you know, when we become obsessed with systematizing Aristotle, with a categorizing Aristotle, with an Aristotle who has no tolerance for ambiguity, and actually the whole question of ambiguity is what is at stake actually in the discussion with Merleau-Ponty at the end of the Merleau-Ponty Reader and the Man in Adversity, the question of, well, how tolerant of ambiguity is Aristotle? I mean, on my reading, and I think you share this to some degree, he's very tolerant of ambiguity in the sense that, you know, it's those moments of ambiguity where he goes to theorize and engage with in the most interesting ways, touch being a perfect example of this. Mm-hmm. And it's not just to, you know, to shoehorn touch into a coherent account of the other senses. He is trying to give a coherent account. There's no question about that. But it is the manner in which touch blurs boundaries, is problematic for simple, easy distinctions between different animal bodies, between animality and plant life, that I think is interesting for him.
Yeah, I agree, and touch has a liminality to it for him. It's on the threshold, and this is something, you know, it isn't. He says that flesh and touch are very corporeal. Of the senses, flesh is the most corporeal organ that we have. In fact, I think this is why, you know, it's so important to think about flesh, which is the medium and the organ for sense. But it's really that very thing that is on the threshold of lapsing into the material world. But touch is this moment where phusis becomes psyche, it becomes psychical. And in that moment, something occurs which marks a fundamental difference for Aristotle. But you're right. There are ways in which he sort of, if you go back through the works in particular, you're going to see an ambiguity. Ambiguities about whether he's going to call flesh, for example, the organ or the medium or neither. And I think when I think about, you know, how we read Aristotle and that question of ambiguity, I think that often, like many of us, depending on what's at stake for him, what he's writing about, what he's trying to talk about, he affords importance to different things at different times. I don't think that means that they're incongruous and that we can't put together a coherent story. In fact, I think we can. But we also have to keep in mind, well, what's at stake for him in this treatise when he's saying this?
Exactly. Can we talk a little bit about your understanding of what you're calling sensation? And I've been subtly, maybe not so subtly, but trying to use the vocabulary of the powers of perceiving, because I have a larger story I want to tell about the nature of perception as being a kind of interaction between subject and object in a way that is that actually I think touch illustrates very effectively, but is also at play in other powers of perceiving. So the Greek there is aisthanestai, to perceive, and it's a middle voiced verb that I want to make something of, in order to emphasize that we ought not to import anachronistically a modern conception of subjectivity back into Aristotle, in which we have sort of a completely self-sufficient active subject and a passive object being received, right? So when you talk about sensation, I associate sensation as emphasizing the receptive side of things, and I think, and I try to talk about powers of perceiving. Now, perceiving could be categorized more as the active side too. So the vocabulary there in English gets to be a kind of a problem. But maybe you could talk, because you emphasize this really nicely, especially when you bring in the notion of the Merleau-Ponty's notion of chiasmic intertwining in your Epoque essay, and then also it's not explicitly brought into the essay that that you'll be presenting this fall, but it's there. It's in the background of that text. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the dynamics of sensation as you see it.
Yeah, I'm really happy you asked about that. I'm actually just happy to have a chance to talk to somebody who works on this about how we designate those terms. I think it's actually Marjorie Green who draws this distinction between sensation and perception. And I think that what she's doing there is she says something like, you know, essentially when we talk about sensation or the act of sensation, it's basically a discrete act, an organ, a sense directed at a particular quality. Perception is more ecological. And this might be what you were getting at with the sort of complete subject and the complete object. And I really think that where Aristotle makes the turn into perception is at the end of Book 2, beginning of Book 3, when he starts talking about the ways in which, you know, perception of perception or sensation of perception, or, you know, that's very tricky. Mm-hmm. And memory, when we bring those things into play. And I do, you know, this is a choice that I make, and then in my own work I try to lay out these are the terms I'm using and this is why I'm using them. And I try to say, you know, that when I'm talking about a particular act, a discrete act, something that Merleau-Ponty actually would say is impossible. And would have a critique of the way that Aristotle presents sensation in the middle of De Anima, that's what I refer to as sensation. And Merleau-Ponty is going to say, well, sensation like that is impossible. There is no such thing. We're always experiencing in an environment a whole. There's always movement involved in perceptual acts, things like that. I think, you know, I accept that critique of Aristotle, but I think it's important for my purposes that I know that I'm talking about sensation in the middle of the De Anima and second half.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's what maybe we differ in that, in the sense that accepting that critique, because I think, so I've tried in Aristotle and the Nature of Truth, tried to argue that actually in the account in De Anima Book 2, Chapter 5, where he addresses the notion of where he talks about ta aisthanestai in sensation, perceiving, whatever you want to call it, if we attend carefully to the sort of structure of that argument and the language that he uses, you actually can see that he has a very very much of an interactive conception of perceiving at stake. Now, I think there's something right to be said about he does try to isolate individual powers and give an account of them individually in a way that which I think Merleau-Ponty would be right to criticize in a certain sense. But it's sort of like as Aristotle sometimes focuses on the material dimension, sometimes on the formal dimension of something, he's pulling things out not because he has an inorganic way of understanding them, but in order to try to flesh out the dynamics of them to see if there's some parallel between the various phenomena.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also, you know, we're not so far apart as it might seem. I think that, you know, I'm really sympathetic to what you suggested earlier, that what we want to avoid is the notion of sensation or perception as a passive act. On either the part of the subject or the object. And for Aristotle, he says, you know, that in the act of sensation, both the object and the sensor are actualized together. though their being is different, he says. And that's a moment of activity for both. The sensor moves from having the hexis or the second potency of being able to sense something to sensing it, the same way a carpenter moves from, you know, having the knowledge of how to build a house to building it when the material is there and he's ready. And the object itself, I mean, it doesn't make sense, right, to talk about an object as sensible, lacking anything or anyone who could sense it or perceive it.
Right. Well, I mean, in that sense, the even in English, the notion of sensible, if we think of it as able to be sensed, there's an activity on the part of the object. There's an activity on the part of the object being perceived that can get missed if you think of subject as active, object as passive. Mm-hmm. In the same way that the subject is at once sort of actively appropriating and receiving the object that it's perceiving. So, I mean, I think getting back, I think it comes to language really beautifully in the discussion of touch when there's a kind of shift in the way Aristotle speaks about the medium. So for most of the time he talks about the medium as metaxu, which is this sort of between that maybe has a connotation, some kind of physical connotation to it. And then he starts talking about it at a decisive point, at least I argue, in the middle of the text, as tomezon, as a mean. And now then when he talks about it as a mean, you have much more of a kind of qualitative dimension. You might even have a discerning kind of cognitive dimension associated with the mean as opposed to that which is between with the vocabulary of metaxu. So I think the one of the reasons why touch is such an important phenomenon for me in Aristotle is because it is where another understanding of interaction emerges, one that is much more dynamic and much more along the lines of what I think Merleau-Ponty would call intertwining.
Yeah, and actually I'd like to ask you a question about that. So when your argument, you could maybe point me towards this, is that he actually will start to refer to that in-between, which is metaxu in most places, as tomeson? Because yeah. Certainly, he starts to talk about the sense itself and touch in particular as operating according to tomeson, a mean, and that of course takes us. You know, we might want to think about the relationship of that. And I do this in my dissertation, going back through the physical world where he uses that term, and then thinking about how it comes up most famously, probably in the Nicomachean Ethics. What is this notion of the mean? But he uses, in fact, that language, tomeson, for the thing that comes between, in reference to the medium of touch in particular.
Yeah, so in fact, I'm not this good, but happily I have my computer here, and I had opened my own essay where I try to make this argument. And this was something that I talked about at the Collegium last year when I gave this paper there. And it's going to be part of a book on a collection of essays on phenomenology and sight and other modes of sensing. Yeah. And so I'm thinking about De Anima, Book 2, Chapter 11, mm-hmm. where he's talking about touch, and the passage I have in mind, I'll just read it since it's right here,
yeah.
Is one in which he is talking about the possibility that perceiving is different in different perceptive powers. So that's what I was trying to say was an issue, a kind of crisis that at least I discern as in the middle of the De Anima that touch enacts. Mm-hmm. And so one of that crisis is in part is it really possible that perceiving is different in different perceptive powers and touch has that threatens that issue. And then he writes, and this is De Anima 2.11, 423b 4 through 8, which I will put in the notes on the blog. He says, but this is not so. He rejects it. It's not so. They're not different powers. But we perceive even the hard and the soft through other things, just as we perceive what is able to make a sound or a sight or a smell. But the latter from far away, namely those distal powers from far away, and the former from nearby, and thus it escapes our notice. So touching and tasting, the way in which the medium works kind of escapes our notice. And then he says, since we perceive them all through a mean, ta mesu, but in the former case, it escapes notice.
Okay.
And so I make kind of a big deal out about that, you know, well, this shift, it actually comes to language, and this is part of my whole attempt to read Aristotle in what I call a logical way, but that it comes to language there, and then when he introduces the vocabulary of tomeson, then you have a really rich way of thinking about the medium that isn't simply physical.
Right. No, and I think that language, where he starts to use meson and mesotes, we both worked on this a little bit, and it's so interesting to think about. You know, for him, everything is an intermediate of some sort, right? I mean, any body, again, those perishable, perceptible bodies, are the intermediaries between the transformation of the elements. And then when we get to the qualities that are perceptible, all of those are intermediates between, you know, visible and invisible. And it sounds like a reference to Merleau-Ponty, but it's actually something that Aristotle himself says, or between tangible and intangible. And there's a point at which something becomes imperceptible to us, and it's too far one way. And there's a point at which it's actually too strong. Now, only in touch does that too strong perceptible destroy the organ, but in every sense, there's a degree to which too much of it, and we can't sense it. And what I argue, and I think you've made similar claims, is that that's because touch and all of our senses operate according to a mean condition, so that we're sort of attuned in a way to respond to things that actually have some sort of underlying similarity to the organ itself, and that we respond in a particular way so long as those things fall within a given range. And that language appears over and over again through his work, within a certain range, that it's in some ways then personal, that, you know, if my skin temperature is a little warmer than yours, I'm going to feel things slightly differently, and there's going to be a degree at which I can't feel something that might be different than the degree at which you might not feel something. And that language comes up in different places for Aristotle. It's, you know, present in the Nicomachean Ethics as well, that it's individual in a particular sense, and that it is particularly tied to discrimination. It's how we discriminate. But that passage that you're pointing to is really important, and I've written on that as well. You know, do we perceive through a medium, and then that he switches the language there is really intriguing.
And I mean, I think, well, and one of the things that you brought to my attention as I was thinking about this and working on the paper, at least your paper on touch and flesh in Aristotle's De Animo in Epoche, is you highlight the passage that happens, I think, a little bit before that, where Aristotle says that, okay, you know, human beings are really not so great with respect to, let's say, smell, right? We're not good at a lot of animals that surpass us in smell, but we're great about touch, and that makes us the most intelligent, right? You quote that in your essay, and I thought that intelligent there is phronematiton, right? So we had the most phronesis. And so that got me also thinking, and something I wanted to ask you also to think along with me on, is, okay, well, if this is so critical that the vocabulary of mean in tomeson is introduced, and as you nicely said, it saturates much of Aristotelian thinking,
yeah,
including ethical political thinking, including the notion of phronesis, and if we think of phronesis as a kind of way of being attuned to the world, different depending on our context, just in the way as your skin temperature might be different from mine, so you might sense something as hot, but still at least not so different that we can't have some kind of objectivity, some kind of at least enough to get a robust ethics out of it. Then what we're really talking about, the importance of touch in Aristotle, goes not only all the way down to very basic ways of interacting between animals engaging with the world, but also to higher and higher levels with regard to our ethical and political interactions with one another.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, I really take it the other direction in my work and think through, you know, the way in which this mean has come out of the physics and out of, you know, the De Kylo, the generation and corruption, the meteorology, and there's been some interesting work done, been 50 years ago or more, on the way in which that might even come out of Greek medicine and the idea of an equilibrium and a balance and, you know, humors, things like that. You know, certainly that's a tradition that Aristotle would have been steeped in. But I thought, you know, I started to think about the ways in which this takes us at least into the ethics. Certainly touch plays an important role there when we think about continents, right? People who are incontinent are particularly prone to fail according to the pleasures of touch. But also, if the mean is in fact physiological as well as psychological, then, I mean, in some ways then we're talking about something like, it makes sense to say, well, this doesn't feel right to me. This doesn't feel just to me. This doesn't feel like the virtuous thing to do here. Feeling, the way in which we use feeling, becomes meaningful for Aristotle in the same way.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that's the direction that I would want to, actually, I would want to push it in both directions. The direction from which you came, namely from the physics, from very basic ways in which physical objects interact with one another, and we as embodied beings, beings with the capacity to touch, interact with our world, to those more... but the higher level of judgments about what is right and what is good. And I love the idea that we would then bring along with that the notion of it feeling right. It, you know, I sense the right thing to do here. So we wouldn't have to have this, we wouldn't have to go into the realm of intuition. Mm-hmm. We could have a vocabulary of feeling our way into situations and having that be not just mushy in the deprecated sense that has all historically happened in philosophy, mm-hmm. but actually as a result of our embodiment in the world and as our way of feeling ourselves into the lives that we live. So, I mean, I think that's a really rich a rich approach, and I think it's one that that resonates in some deep ways with something like what Merleau-Ponty is talking about. Maybe I can get you to talk a little bit about that, about Merleau-Ponty, because I think, you know, the vocabulary of entwining and you know, that great image that Merleau-Ponty has of holding hands and, mm-hmm. and the touch associated with that, I think is really relevant to what we're talking about.
Yeah, and I, you know, I actually move right from in the dissertation, the work on the mean, into the discussion of the flesh, so I see that as the transition for both Aristotle and Merleau-Ponty in a way. And basically what, you know, ultimately where I end is that the mean, whether we're talking about it in reference to sensation and then perception or with ethics, it's a state of readiness. And that readiness for Aristotle, and I would extend this down to plant life as well. Plants don't have the mean condition, but yet simply by virtue of being living beings, they are in a state of readiness to engage with the world. They are open to the world in a very limited material way. They can take in nutrition and grow because of it. They can't sense it. They can't move to it. They can't, I'm probably going to get people who complain about this thing, but they can't desire it. And I'll set that aside for the moment.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I do think that plants can have locomotion, but they clearly move toward the light. They have this stretching. Now, whether we want to characterize it as desire or not is another question. I share your concern about that boundary between plant life and animal life.
And I call it the collegium question when people like to say, but the sunflowers, they turn to the sun. And I mean, and Aristotle would, I presume, have seen this and noticed this. But so, I mean, in moving, though, from, you know, this mean condition into the flesh, what I'm really thinking about is that openness and that readiness. What is the ground for this openness where all of the sudden, out of the physical world, we get something that can do all these things, like respond, react, recognize, you know, and that's one of these rewords, cognize, to know again as if it already knew. And all of those terms have reflect, recognize, react, have that sense of, again, to turn, to go back to something. And what we want to think about then is, well, what is it in that living being that is both similar to the things to which it's responding and yet differentiates itself from them? And that's where I think Merleau-Ponty can be very helpful to us, because he really delved into this in the work on the flesh in an incomplete way. And to some extent, I'd say maybe Aristotle can help us a little bit with that unfinished part of Merleau-Ponty and think about it. But for Merleau-Ponty, this is where he's going to start to use the language of, in his early work, structure behavior, it was more integration, things like that. But he does make this turn to calling it kinship, intertwining. He talks about the chiasm. And what he's really talking about is the difference. But he doesn't want to talk about the difference in a way that reifies it, that makes it into something substantial that has to be overcome. And this gets back to his anti-Cartesianism in a way. He doesn't want to give power to that difference that allows us to say distance, difference, that's the problem of philosophy in many ways. How do we overcome that? How do we come to get to something on the other side of that? And what he says, he uses this French term, écart. But really what he wants that to mean is something like divergence. And the difference between, sorry, I'm repeating my language here, but between difference and divergence has to do with whether or not they are at first one or whether they are not one, and something that have to be brought together. And I think that that grounding that I was talking about for both Merleau-Ponty and Aristotle is in a kind of unity. The living being, any living being, is a unity of the material world and its form, which is its soul. But it's not, for Aristotle, it's not the same problem that we post-Cartesians have, where we have to then reconcile. Well, how do they come together? And, you know, what's, you know, how does, where's the material before it's informed? And what is it? And how do we constitute it? For Aristotle, I really think it's a, this is where the title of the paper comes in, a psychophysical unity before it's thinking about the soul and the body, or as he might also put it, the matter and the form. And understanding that for him, the unity is prior to any separation, and we make those separations, and Aristotle makes those separations. He makes them logically, he makes them when he writes, because in order to explain these things, we have to break them down into parts, but that doesn't mean those parts have a priority over the unified compound, the hylomorphic compound that is the living being.
I think, I mean, what you're pointing to, from my perspective, is what brings Aristotle into connection with somebody like Merleau-Ponty, but also into connection with somebody like John Dewey and some of the other, what I would call, what characterize people like John Herman Randall, Frederick Woodbridge, as American, as this naturalistic thinking, and by that I simply mean exactly what we're talking about, namely we begin with the unity of mind and body. We begin with this organic whole, and then we make the distinctions. I think Merleau-Ponty does the same thing, and I think Aristotle does the same thing, so it becomes anachronistic when we read a certain kind of mind-body problem into Aristotle, because we've just been sort of so steeped in a kind of Cartesian way of understanding the difference between mind and body, so that they've been reified into substances that have to somehow be brought back together. But when we begin with an organic, when we begin, as Dewey does, as Merleau-Ponty does, and as Aristotle does, with a sense of the unity of the whole, then we don't have a problem. We don't have a chasm to bridge there.
Yeah, I agree. I'm hesitant, I mean, and I don't think you would intend this either, to reduce either Merleau-Ponty or Aristotle to just being sort of naturalist or vitalist or something like that, because there is something else going on for both of them. You know, I don't think ultimately Merleau-Ponty would say, you know, it comes down to simple chemistry and we can eventually explain all of this divergence away or anything like that. But I agree that there's a naturalism to both of them. And in fact, one of the people who I've more recently been bringing into this is Hans Jonas. And that there's also the way that he's going to talk about phenomenology and biological life. And maybe that's something that you also do in your work.
I think Jonas is I mean, he's great, and I went to the New School, so you have to love Hans Jonas, who taught there for many years. And but I just want to clarify something about the once I drop the N word, the naturalism word, it can set things into a wrong direction. So I appreciate just a second to say something about that, because you're right to suggest that there is a version of naturalism, a kind of reductive naturalism that's attempting to give an account of nature in terms of, I don't know what you want to talk about, whether it's materialistic, atomistic, chemical terms. But when I refer to somebody like Dewey or John Herman Rander or Woodbridge, I'm thinking very much about a kind of naturalism that is non-reductive and inclusive. And so by importing that over into Merleau-Ponty, I think a lot of people balk at it, and understandably so. But I still don't want to necessarily give up on the vocabulary of a certain kind of naturalism, just because by that I really mean what you are articulating, namely that we begin with the organic whole.
Yes.
And then that's where we begin to address the phenomena that we encounter.
And that there's a commitment on Aristotle's part to talking about psyche in the same terms that he's brought in from his physics and from the physical world, that he wants very much to be able to apply all of the language of motion, of alteration, of matter and form, of potency and actuality, to the capacities of the living being. So I would agree that there's a sense in which there's a very rich notion of naturalism in Aristotle. And, you know, there's some tight fits for him on some of those. Some of those things require a lot of finesse on his part. How do we talk about sensation in terms of an alteration? When alteration, for so much of his work, has a very clear, you know, it's between contraries from one state to another, entails the destruction of the prior state. And he wants to use that same word in the same language, and yet he has to qualify it, right? It's tis alioisis. It's a certain kind of alteration. So that, and that's where psychical life becomes something slightly divergent from purely physical life.
And that's, I mean, that goes back to the whole question of how we read Aristotle, right? We have to attend to those qualifications, tis, these, mm-hmm. these, a certain kind of alteration. How different? And I guess this goes back to the issue that we were sort of thinking around earlier, which is the question of the boundary between plant life and animal life, and the way touch plays into that. I mean, as you were talking about that, I got to think a little bit more about the role of habit and hexis, the role of habituation in this area. I know there's something also that Merleau-Ponty takes up, but maybe it's, and it goes to the vocabulary you were using of recognition, repetition, remembering. Maybe there is something about the way in which animals can habituate themselves and can take ownership of their own habits to some degree that it at least differentiates them from plant life. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, for Aristotle, to be an animal is already to be in what he calls the second potency, a kind of haxis for sensation. You know, it's not like an animal that's sleeping has completely lost its capacity to see or to smell.
As your dog.
Evidenced by the sleeping dog. If I were to cook some toast, he'd be up.
Right.
Simply by a sense of smell. And yet, there's also this other meaning for habit that we get more in the Nicomachean Ethics and things like that, which is really the things that we've trained ourselves to do, the things that we've learned, the habits that we acquire over a lifetime. And I think that for Aristotle, you know, if that's the boundary, and that's a really interesting way to think about the boundary between plant life and animal life, are animals those things which can habitualize themselves, can come to inhabit certain perspectives on the world such that they're not assaulted by them constantly. And I think that is certainly accurate, right? If we were to, and this is in great part what I think a lot of the discussion of sensation revolves around for Aristotle, we can't sense everything that comes our way. In fact, we have to habitualize ourselves to not sense certain things, and primarily it's those sensations that pertain to touch. If I felt, every hair as it fell, or every article of clothing as it fell on my body, if I were constantly feeling the chair or the floor underneath me, I couldn't do anything. And in fact, that makes me think that habitualization to especially touch is part of why we are the most hieronymous, because it allows us that to move past our corporeality, to forget, to actively forget our own corporeality in a way.
Right, right. And I mean, and then of course extending that out further, that becomes a real problem when the entire history of philosophy has actively forgotten its own embodiment.
Absolutely, right. I mean, that is in some ways the beauty of touch, is that it is so predominant that allows us to, it effaces itself in a way. It allows us that. And vision, gives us that distance, and we don't so simply shut down the things we see. Certainly, and this is something Merleau-Ponty and, talks a lot about, but we can shut down the peripheral stuff, and we get the great notion of the figure in the background out of Gestalt psychology. But really, Aristotle recognizes in a way that so much of touch is not passivity, but it's also, it's not, as to use your language, being attentive to in a particular way.
Yeah, and so, I mean, then if we push that yet a little bit further, when you were making a distinction between the kind of second actuality, the kind of habituation that sort of every animal is by virtue of being alive and by holding itself in its existence,
yes.
And the higher level of habits that are cultivated in ethical life and interhuman ethical life, I mean, we have to see the continuity between, it's always a certain kind of hexis, it's always a certain kind of, in a certain sense, cultivated way of holding oneself actively in existence.
Yeah, and I mean, we both use this language of holding, one of the things I talk about is that to be a living being is to hold oneself together as the very thing which one is. And for Aristotle, that is clear throughout the discussion of plants, animals, human beings, that is the primary activity of the living being, is to hold itself together as it works towards its telos, as it enacts its form. And yet, it's not separate from, and I would say that it's a unified living being with a twofold aim, and that is one part of it, holding itself together, but so is interacting. You are not a living being should you cease to interact in the world. And so for Aristotle, it's both of those. It's finding the boundaries at which we can both maintain our own existence as what we are while engaging in the world. And sensation is the first real refinement of that capacity. And in fact, touch is the first real refinement of that, because I am not changed by the hard, cold thing I touched into a hard, cold thing, the way that fire, can change the thing with potency for fire. Instead, I might suffer some small change because touch is the most corporeal of my senses. And then we get up to sight, where I am basically physically unaffected by the sensible object. But in touch,
unless something's too bright, right?
Exactly. And then my organ is damaged in some way. But in touch, there's some, this is the tis alioisis for him. This is where I have to be able to live that, to interact with that without being constantly threatened by my own destruction by it. And of course, touch, where I'm closest to the object, right upon the object, is again proton in the sense that I need to be very quickly, so there's an immediacy to touch that is not present for Aristotle, in the distal senses, and I need to be very finely attuned to what will cause me pleasure or pain and what might destroy me. Because if I touch it, I'm not going to become it right away, but if it's bad for me, it will start to damage me.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in that sense, I think this vocabulary of holding oneself in existence and the metaphor of holding is a touch metaphor is one in which there it's not just a matter of grasping in a rigid sense, right? There has to be finesse to it. There has to be subtlety. There's a range of things that one can experience and continue to maintain oneself in existence, but there are some things that one can't. And that's where, when he says, once you've lost the capacity to touch, you've lost the capacity to live. That, right? Unlike when you've lost the capacity to see, because some bright thing has shined in your eyes, you can't see, you still can live, but you've lost that one single power. So, I mean, it does again speak to the, as you say, the priority of touch in at the very, very deepest level of the life of the animal.
Right. And I suppose for Aristotle, potentially you could live in a vegetative state if you've lost the sense of touch, but you couldn't live as an animal. You could not interact in the world. You could not be in the world the way an animal is in the world. Once that capacity has failed you, it's absolutely impossible for him. Yeah.
Well, I think there's probably no better place for us to conclude our discussion here than in the discussion of how without the capacity to touch, we will lose our capacity to live.
Yes, of course. That's the end of everything.
Exactly. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me on the Digital Dialogue. It's been great. This on-air model has been really fun to have both the interaction in terms of audio, but also to be able to see you and to see the different cues that one gets from seeing somebody's face.
Right. Of course, I would just say the synesthetic experience is always better than the single sense experience. So seeing and hearing gives us more than simply one or the other.
Excellent. And I see that your lovely dog in the background is beginning to wake up. So now, is it a boy or a girl dog?
A boy dog, and it must be close to dinner time if he's starting to wake up. An older boy dog.
Well, he's very cute. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share and share alike license. You can find all the episodes of the Digital Dialogue on www.cplong.org, where you're invited to listen and leave comments and engage with other listeners. The Digital Dialogue also has a Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.